From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2008, Congress passed the so-called Mental Health Parity Act. It says your insurance company has to cover psychotherapy, psychiatric emergencies, and other health problems, mental health problems, just like they do doctor's visits, x-rays, and surgeries. But there's a small and growing chorus of complaints and even lawsuits alleging that insurance companies are still shortchanging the mentally ill. This hour on Point, health insurance, mental health coverage, and parity. You can join us on air or online. Have you had a hard time getting your insurance company to pay for a family member's counseling or prescriptions? Do you think insurers should cover couples therapy, addiction counseling, the same as a checkup or a blood test? Join us at OnPointRadio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPointRadio. Joining me first from San Francisco this hour is Jenny Gold. She's a correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's been reporting on the problem of mental health parity, and you can find links to her reporting on our website, onpointradio.org. We should note that Kaiser Health News is not affiliated with the managed care group Kaiser Permanente. Jenny, great to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So, 2008, Congress passes this landmark law, the Parity Law, to ensure that patients with mental health problems can get treatment as easily as somebody with physical problems. Help us understand the problems that existed that this law was supposed to fix.
Well, one thing I think it's important to note is the law did a lot, but it didn't actually require insurers to provide mental health coverage. They can still not provide it if they want, or some of them can. What it requires is that if they provide mental health coverage, they have to provide it on par with physical health benefits. So basically, what was going on before the law was passed was that there were really disparate coverage options. So insurers would cover, you know, surgical care and medical care really, really fully. But on the mental health side, they were doing things like having annual limits on the number of therapy visits. Maybe your insurer would only cover 10 a year, or they might charge you a higher copay for a visit with a psychiatrist, or they might have a separate deductible that was higher that just applied to mental health care. So this law was supposed to come in and change all of those things.
And did it? With this disparate coverage options, did it work?
Well, so we've got evidence that in some ways insurers really have changed the way they're covering mental health care. Those annual limits on therapy visits, higher copays, separate deductibles have largely become a thing of the past. Not entirely, and not all insurers are complying, but there's definitely been a big improvement. But the advocates and lawyers, providers, lawmakers, and consumers are saying that insurers have found other kind of sneakier ways to avoid paying for treatment. Things like reviewing the necessity of mental health care more strictly than they review, say, the need for surgical care. So they might say, your doctor says you need 2 visits a week with a psychiatrist, but we think you don't really need this. Or they might require more pre-authorization, which can be hard to get. So all of these things are ways that they actually are illegal under the Mental Health Parity Act, but they're a lot harder to catch. And people are saying insurers are still using them. You can kind of think about it as a bar of soap, right? And the government tried to squeeze the bar of soap on one side and prevent insurers from doing some discriminatory acts against consumers. But the soap bar kind of popped out the other side. They found other ways to do it.
So a lot harder to catch these discriminatory acts. What about enforcement?
Right.
What does enforcement look like, and who's responsible for it?
So enforcement is split, which makes it harder to follow. It's split between state insurance commissioners and 3 federal agencies, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Labor, and the Department of Treasury. So there's not one single agency responsible for overseeing discrimination. In my research, I found that in the 7 years since the federal law has passed, the federal government has not taken a single public enforcement action against an insurer or an employer for violating the mental health parity law. There have been no government lawsuits, no fines, and no public announcements. And really, only a handful of states have even started digging into whether or not insurers are complying.
And so some consumers are taking matters into their own hands and taking insurance companies to court, right, saying that they're not following the law. What about these lawsuits?
So there are just a handful of lawsuits at this point. They're really hard to bring. It's very complicated for consumers. It's expensive to bring a lawsuit. And think about the folks that are facing this discrimination. A lot of them have a mental illness or are dealing with a family member with one. Those are exhausting. It's hard to bring a case. There's also still, unfortunately, a stigma in the country attached to mental illness. And to come forward with the lawsuit, in some way, you have to come public with your own mental illness. That's a really difficult thing to do.
A ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals last week has changed the equation here. Tell us about this watershed ruling.
Well, a little bit. So what it's done is it's allowed some more consumers to actually bring lawsuits against insurers. So previously, if you had you got your insurance through your big employer, and the employer was paying for all the coverage, those are called self-insured plans. You could go and sue your employer, but you couldn't sue the insurer. And it's hard to bring a lawsuit against the person that the group that employs you.
Right.
What this lawsuit, what this decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals did was it said, okay, consumers, you can now sue those insurers directly. So it's one less barrier for a lot of patients. But it doesn't necessarily apply across the whole country. It's just this one district right now.
43 million Americans ages 18 and older, about a sixth of all adults report having some mental health issue, some mental health illness. That does not include substance abuse disorders. Talk about the mental health needs in this country, Jenny Gold.
I mean, the mental health needs are enormous, and we know that a lot of people still aren't getting care. And one of the top reasons they're listing for why they're not seeking care is that it's too expensive. And that means that insurance companies maybe still aren't covering it as they need to. I spoke with one state official in California, who's in charge of monitoring insurance plans for mental health benefits. And I will say California and New York have done actually a pretty good job looking for parity violations. And she said insurance companies still think of mental health as a second class benefit. Mm-hmm. They still don't necessarily think of it as being as important as covering things like a surgery or chemotherapy.
So you talk about the expense of this. What do insurance companies say? We'll hear from a representative of the insurance companies later in the broadcast. But tell us why this is important from their side. They say that keeping costs down is part of their job, that mental health coverage is complicated.
Absolutely. So, I mean, insurers, they say, look, this is really hard and complicated to enforce, to implement. Basically, they say mental health care and medical care are sort of like trying to compare apples and oranges. And this idea of providing exactly equal coverage is a really complicated idea. They say, listen, the science on mental health care is constantly evolving, so we may be changing our coverage requirements. And they are right. They do still have to consider things like cost. You know, for the last 5 years, we've really been having a national conversation about getting health costs down. They say, look, we are trying to do that, and this is part of our effort. They have also been really busy trying to implement changes from the Affordable Care Act. I think one of the problems here is that the parity law was passed just a little tiny bit before this enormous package of Obamacare. And insurance companies have largely been focused on implementing those changes and not as much. With parity, they say, you know, they are actively working with state and federal governments to comply in a way that's cost effective for patients. I think, you know, in some way we can expect insurers to kind of try to save money when they can. I think, you know, one of the big problems here is really the lack of enforcement by the federal and state governments. That's really the problem. If they don't hold the insurers' feet to the fire, if they don't really enforce this law, I think consumers can't necessarily expect insurers to always, you know, implement it in exactly the right way.
Speaking to a House committee back in 2007, then Democratic Representative Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island spoke from personal experience. He said he was able to rise above his alcoholism, his drug addiction, his bipolar disorder because of the parity law.
I have, through the course of my life, had periods of time where I have had a mental obsession and physical compulsion to drink and use drugs in order to cope with a mental anguish that I have felt that today I no longer have to deal with through drinking and drugging, because I am a member of Congress and have access to the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan, which has parity.
What about addiction as a brain disease and a big push for insurers to, you know, cover these classic chronic disease medications like methadone and Suboxone like they do insulin or antidepressant medications?
So absolutely. It's really important to note that even though it's called the Mental Health Parity Act, that we are including substance abuse and addiction here, and we know there's a huge and for some drugs growing problem with addiction and abuse in the country. And this is supposed to come in and say, look, you guys can get coverage and get help as well. So this is also supposed to ensure that people with addiction and substance abuse issues can also get coverage and treatment.
You've reported, Jenny Gold, that of the 26 managed care insurers, none of them were able to prove that they were fully compliant with the law. Is that correct?
So you're referring to California. So that's right. So that's the California Department of Managed Health Care. That's the department here in California, where I am, that is responsible for enforcing the rules against managed health care insurers.
And so then how widespread is the problem among insurance companies nationwide?
We don't necessarily know. And the reason is California is sort of the only state that's gone out proactively and looked at whether or not insurers are complying. Everywhere else, including the federal government, is largely relying on consumer helplines. They're relying on patients to call in and say, oh, I think my insurer might not be providing me enough benefits. Well, that's really hard for people to do. So California went and decided to look themselves. And they found that none of the 26 managed health plans were complying.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the federal mental health parity law and asking whether insurance companies are actually following that law. We're hearing today that they are not. Later in the hour, we'll hear the insurer's side of the story, but you can join the conversation here now. Mental health workers and therapists, are you running into a wall when you try to bill your patients' insurers for care you think they need? Patients, have you given up the fight with your insurer on mental health coverage because of the embarrassment or the stigma attached to the treatment that you were getting? My guest this hour, Jenny Gold, correspondent for Kaiser Health News Service. Let's bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Mehram Bendat. He's a lawyer and a psychotherapist. He's the founder of Psych Appeal. That's a law firm representing consumers in mental health complaints against health insurance companies. He's filed a series of lawsuits on behalf of consumers who are suing their insurance companies for violating the 2008 mental health care parity law. Mehram, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. When it comes to mental health services, from your perspective, how widespread are the problems associated with the parity law?
They're rather extensive and pervasive throughout the country. We have seen over the past several years that, particularly when dealing with patients with chronic mental health conditions, that insurers just don't want them on their registers.
So give us an example of that, and specifically what your client has gone through, your clients, when they could not get mental health coverage.
Well, obviously, when our clients cannot get mental health coverage, there are various repercussions to them. We've had a number of family members turn to us after their loved ones had actually committed suicide or overdosed due to not having access to mental health care despite being theoretically covered by insurance. Really what we're seeing is that folks with chronic conditions like major depressive disorder, schizophrenia, any of a host of what are considered major or severe mental illnesses, who are really wrestling with these conditions for the better part of their lives, are just essentially being managed only for acute flares as opposed to preventing the deterioration of their conditions. And that's really tragic.
Here's Michael Kamens. He's one of your clients. He's currently suing his healthcare provider, Optum, over their treatment of his son's depression. Here, Kamens describes to New Hampshire Public Radio what it was like seeing his son's psychiatric meetings get cut from 13 times a month to 2 times a month. This was at a time when his son desperately needed help.
I'll make the analogy of somebody drowning who finally gets to the surface of a lake. His head comes out, he gasps for air, and what does Optum do? They shove him down again.
By the way, we invited Optum onto our show, but because of the ongoing litigation, in this case, they declined the offer. Mehram Bendat, talk about this case specifically and what your client went through with his son.
Well, this particular case entails the insurer's decision to limit my client's son's access to basic psychotherapy. So my client's son, who in late adolescence, kind of late teenage years, was diagnosed with a series of conditions that are quite severe, bipolar disorder, substance abuse. And that's oftentimes the age of onset for these conditions in men. And unfortunately, despite the pleas of the patient psychiatrist to have him continue to receive psychotherapy on a twice to three time weekly basis, at least for some additional period of time, the insurer decided from an ivory tower that it somehow knew better. That unfortunately led to my client's son getting less access to care over time and eventually deteriorating and being hospitalized. Hmm.
Jenny Gold, does your reporting bear this out?
Well, that actually was my reporting that you played from Kaiser Health News and NPR. Absolutely. I mean, I spoke with Michael Kamens, and it was a really tragic story of his very beloved son who really had not gotten the care that even his doctors and multiple doctors felt was appropriate. And I keep hearing this over and over again from various patients who've been through the experience that for one reason or another, an insurer has made it really difficult for them to get the care that they and their doctors feel they need. And it's not clear exactly why mental health is sort of picked on in this way by insurers. There's some evidence that, you know, treating mental health care can have impact on all forms of someone's health and can really improve someone's well-being. But that is still what a lot of people are experiencing.
Mehram Bendat, Jenny talked about this earlier, but from your perspective, how do insurance companies get out of complying?
Well, that's for one, without having anyone to enforce the regulations or the rules, it's a kind of free for all, and you know, it's like the teacher is out and the sub is in, so everybody has a party, and so the lack of enforcement is really, I think, unfortunately, the first kind of incentive for having policies and procedures that seem to not really adhere to the spirit of the parity laws.
A lot of callers are here. This is an important topic for many. Let's get Frank in here from New York first. Hi, Frank. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you for having this show. It's so important. I'm a psychiatrist here in New York City, and I had a question for your guest and also a comment to make. I specialize in it. Disorder called borderline personality disorder, which affects somewhere between 2 and 6% of the American population and has a 10% suicide rate. Insurance companies would arbitrarily and categorically refuse to cover this disorder and others like it, saying they're too complex, which is kind of crazy because the human being is complex and the mind is complex. They would only treat what they call episodes of illness. And as Mr. Benda just said, most people have illnesses that go beyond the acute episode. So I'm not sure that the parity law has changed what the insurance companies are doing for these more complex disorders like personality disorders. I'd like your guest's opinion on that. But I also wanted to make the point and see if your guests had any opinion on the following problem. Insurance companies seem just to be kicking the can down the road. There's an acute episode. They take care of that. They don't really care about the core problem. So what we see in our patients is partially treated patients. Hmm. They continue to suffer. The families continue to suffer. And society winds up paying a huge amount because these patients will need treatment almost forever, but in spurts rather than an intensive treatment that might really get them functioning. Mm.
Frank, thank you. Thank you so much. Mehram, that refers to the acute flares that you brought up earlier. But what about this notion of insurance companies kicking the can down the road with these partially treated patients with mental health issues?
Well, given that historically in the United States, individuals have their insurance benefits through employers and that people tend to change jobs, they tend to change careers with some frequency, there, at least from my assessment, seems to be or to have been a trend to view any particular insured as someone who is just a kind of passerby. And if the insurers recognize that particular members, insureds, are not going to be with them over the long course, then what's their incentive mm-hmm. to really invest in their well-being now, knowing that they're going to essentially foot the bill for someone who's then going to switch jobs, end up with a different insurer, and possibly not be a big expense to the next person. And so kind of the question comes down to why absorb the cost now when you can just pass it down.
And Jenny, to Frank's other point, this is not a simple calculus for anyone. I mean, the treatment plan for chronic heart disease is very different from the treatment plan for a patient seeking care for depression, right? Speak to that.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is the insurance company's argument that, like I said before, these are apples and orange comparisons. But when you get down to the nitty gritty of, you know, the benefits package, I mean, the law and the regulations that came out are pretty explicit about what they need to cover and what they don't need to cover. I mean, in a lot of ways, this isn't really a secret. I mean, for example, the review that insurance companies do for whether or not a patient's benefits ought to be a patient's treatment should or should not be covered cannot be more stringent for mental health. So while it's complicated, I mean, the benefits are on paper. I mean, they can and they are compared. Mm.
Jenny Mehram, hold for a second. I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. We want to hear how this whole issue of parity in coverage looks from the perspective of the insurance companies. I should note that we worked very hard to get a representative from health insurance companies and their trade associations, but none of them were able to make the time today. Speaking in their stead is Devin Herrick. He's a health economist and formerly a healthcare accountant for a large Dallas hospital. He's now a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis and an occasional columnist for Town Hall. He joins us from Dallas, Texas. Devin, thanks for being on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Jane.
So what do you hear in this conversation? Is it fair to say that insurers see mental health as second-tier benefits?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily accurate. As Jenny mentioned, prior to the Health Parity Act of 2008, what a lot of insurance companies did is they would have a limited number of treatments they would pay for, or maybe even a limited dollar amount. Well, of course, that's no longer legal. So what they do is they employ things like utilization review and case management. Now, this is not necessarily, she called it a sneaky way of rationing care. I don't think that's really accurate. All payers, including the federal government, you know, Medicare, is looking at accountable care. Well, what is accountable care? That's the right care at the right time in the right setting. And so utilization review and utilization management are really ways of trying to ensure that patients who really need the care are getting the care they need at the appropriate time and in the appropriate setting. Because the problem, as you just mentioned, is there really aren't the same objective standards for mental illness as there are for, say, heart disease. Heart disease, you can measure blockage. For diabetes, you can measure blood glucose. So I think what we're seeing, it's really a work in progress. providers and payers are grappling, trying to figure out what are the appropriate protocols.
There also isn't incentive, right, Mr. Herrick, for insurance companies? I mean, our caller Frank brought this up, for insurance companies to invest in patients now because, you know, maybe they'll switch jobs, they'll switch to another insurance company, and why should they foot the bill for someone who's going to move on and be somebody else's problem down the road?
Well, I have to agree with Mayram. It's the what's known as the churn in employer health insurance markets is about 20%. So, you know, the average length of stay could be, you know, roughly, you know, 1 in 5 people who are in your pool this year won't be next year. And you know, the average length of stay in a pool may be 5 years. So, and that's true of a lot of areas. It's not just mental health care. You know, some people would say, well, how come insurance companies don't tackle obesity more? Why don't they tackle a lot of chronic diseases more? Well, employers are putting a lot of money and a lot of interest in chronic disease management. But the problem is they find they actually spend more chasing down those few individuals who will benefit than they get back in terms of what they invest in the programs. And that's true of all kinds of things. So that's an issue where we have to deal with through, you know, for health insurance in general. But there's a special problem for, you know, mental illness simply because it's not as straightforward. It is very complicated. Mm-hmm. And so I think we could agree that it's, as far as mental health parity and what that means, how that works out, it is a work in progress. And we are trying to figure out the protocols and the step therapy, for example.
Let me get Brad in here from Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Brad. Thanks for calling. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead,
right,
please.
My question concerns Medicare. My wife has had two appointments or sessions a week up to this point, or every 2 weeks, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And Medicare says that they're not medically necessary, even though our insurance company is willing to pay for them.
Hmm. So Medicare is denying payment of these visits. Brad, thank you so much. Jenny Gold, is that an issue that you see a lot in your reporting?
You know, I actually haven't looked significantly into Medicare's law. They're slightly different for Medicare. So I'm going to pass that and see if Mayram might be able to answer it.
What do you think, Mr. Bendat?
So it really, it's a tough question to answer here because it's not clear who's making the decisions in this particular patient's case. Medicare sometimes is managed by the insurers. Sometimes it's managed directly by itself. So I don't really know which plan we're talking about, and it's hard to comment. I can tell you that the federal mental health parity law does not expressly apply to Medicare at this point.
Devin Herrick, when is it legitimate, Devin Herrick, for insurance companies to deny coverage to patients seeking mental health services?
Well, I should support what Jenny said earlier. Mental health affects physical health, and so it is a very important area. But as far as denying, what they tend to do is they use, as I mentioned earlier, step therapy. That is, you know, an example that might be you go to your primary care physician. Your physician might give you a generic Prozac initially. If you don't improve, your primary care physician may refer you to a psychiatrist. And, you know, as you go up the steps, the most extreme might be an inpatient admission to a psychiatric hospital. So what I see more is insurance companies are trying to pick the appropriate setting. They're trying to coordinate the care and basically steer the patients to the setting that they think is appropriate for that condition at that time.
And aren't they also trying to control costs?
Well, that's all part of the process of, you know, they don't just say, oh, please go to the psychiatric hospital first, because that's the most expensive step and one that is oftentimes unnecessary. So, yeah, they go up the steps in the protocol, and it's, I think it's referred to as fail first. Well, it's not necessarily failing first. It's trying to pick the appropriate setting for care, and that's part of what accountable care is, and including in Medicare, which is really pushing the concept of accountable care and trying to get private insurers to adopt that. So in a way, private insurers are doing what they've been instructed to do by the examples that are being set by the federal government through Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're hearing today accusations against the health insurance industry saying that too often insurers won't pay for mental health coverage to the extent that federal laws require them to, that they take shortcuts to find ways to say no to consumers. And we're hearing why the insurance industry does not see it that way. My guests today are Jenny Gold of Kaiser Health News, Devin Herrick, a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, and Mehram Bendat, a lawyer and psychotherapist who's been suing insurance companies on behalf of consumers for violating the 2008 mental health care parity law. So many listeners here. Let's get Kate in here from Boston. Hi, Kate. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Go ahead.
My younger brother, has struggled with heroin addiction as well as depression and ADHD. About 2 years ago, we were trying to get him into an inpatient treatment program, and we were told by our insurance company that he'd met the yearly maximum for that benefit. He had been in several treatment programs, was cycling in and out and really struggling. My parents had the financial resources to pay for private treatment, and he actually did really well after a long-term treatment program, something that our insurance company refused to pay for. We were turned away many times, including he was turned away from detoxes because he was said to be not medically necessary because he couldn't die from withdrawal from heroin. Mm. So we really struggled with the insurance company and the coverage, and I'm wondering, is this something that the parity law would now say is not allowed? Because I can't imagine, I'm a nurse, and it's hard for me to imagine someone being non-compliant with their diabetic meds many times over and having many admissions to the hospital and then finally being denied because they're not taking their meds. So that's my question.
Kate, thank you so much. Yeah, no, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Mehram, would you speak to that? How does the parity law apply to Kate's family?
So I should just clarify that the Affordable Care Act has actually mandated that mental health and substance abuse treatment be considered essential treatment and a required piece of the coverage now in all of the ACA plans, to which mental health parity also applies, meaning that it's an additional protection. So you've got now a two-prong kind of punch that should apply, which is essential benefits and mental health parity. And clearly, what Kate just described is something that we at our office confront on a daily basis. We recently heard from a family member of a young man who was in a hospital that recommended step down to rehabilitation. The insurer said no on a Friday. He was dead by Sunday. Mm. And so part of this is just common sense. Let's pay more attention to what psychiatrists have to say and stop second-guessing them. And secondly, part of it is, these step therapy and fail-first protocols that are secretly and sometimes not so secretly. There are still some insurers that actually expressly condition benefits on these kind of both unlawful and at the same time medically insupportable protocols. And we really need to pay attention to that.
Jenny Gold, let me ask you this question. If patients who are on medication to regulate their mental health, some feel that it's difficult, that the insurance companies make it hard to get their medications. You know, they're strictly regulated, things like Suboxone and methadone. There's a criminal element to the distribution of these medications. You know, there's a guard at the door, there's an ID required, and some of that, of course, is necessary. But what do you say to that, that patients say that this is, it's really not easy, that the insurance company is making it hard?
Well, I mean, I know that some companies in their drug formularies are making it difficult to get certain drugs or not get certain other drugs. I haven't looked much into the methadone clinic and those guard issues, but I did just want to add, in response to Devin Herrick earlier talking about accountable care and the fact that insurance companies are across the country in both medical and mental health care trying to find different ways to manage care and manage costs. And you know, that's perfectly legal. They are absolutely allowed to require pre-authorization or find, you know, other ways to kind of reduce costs. The problem and the question here isn't whether they're doing that, but rather whether they're doing it more stringently for mental health care than for other kinds of care. That's the core question. And I found in my reporting that there's some evidence, you know, across the country that they are. For example, a 2015 poll from the National Alliance on Mental Illness found that patients said they were denied care by an insurer because it was deemed not medically necessary twice as often for mental health care than for medical care. Data from the federal government in 2010 found that insurers were still frequently reviewing mental health treatment significantly more stringently than other kinds of care, including these sort of requiring pre-authorization more often, requiring this fail-first protocol more often. And even in the plans that the federal government themselves are saying are okay, in 2015, a study from Johns Hopkins found that a quarter of plans sold on two state exchanges, these are plans that were okayed by HHS, by the federal government, actually were violating parity laws. So we do know that this is happening.
A quick response from you, Devin Herrick.
Well, what Jenny says is correct in many ways. You know, these protocols, step therapies are designed the way they are partly because if it's for heart disease, for example, you can measure blockage and you know, there's very objective standards. We don't oftentimes have the same objective standards for mental issues. You have a very subjective description by patients or doctors. So I, because of the more ambiguity of treatment progress, I would expect these conditions to be closely monitored to make sure they're effective.
Let me get Zach in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Derek, thank you so much. Devin, Zach, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
Honestly, this falls right in with what he just said. I was admitted into an inpatient rehab facility for alcoholism in perhaps 2011, maybe 2012. And 3 weeks into a 4 week program, my last week was denied by my insurer. I was a private insurer through my employer, and it was not medically necessary. And I don't feel like there was a structure for them to know that information. Mm. I don't think they were able to speak with my counselors. They certainly didn't interview me or even give me a survey to know that couldn't have been medically necessary. And that was pretty stressful to find out.
And how are you doing now, Zach?
I'm doing quite well, but that's by my own strength and following the program the way I see I should. But at the time, there's no way that they could have known that would have come through, as, you know, when 75% of people relapse and end up in rehab again. I feel like that was a risk that they should not have taken and had no reason to take.
Zach, thank you very much for the call. Here's Jennifer, also in Nashville. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I'm so glad that you guys are having this discussion today. My daughter has actually just gotten home from long-term residential care and has been struggling with mental health issues for quite some time. And now we seem to have good insurance. But one of the things our insurance company over the first few years of this journey did, I have a question about, is that they had a separate deductible for mental health benefits and for physical health benefits. So essentially, we ended up, it was like a $10,000 deductible, so we ended up with really a $20,000 deductible. And so when I actually wrote them and said, so, you know, you have to treat mental and physical health the same, they wrote me back and said, well, we do because they both have the same deductible. But having that separate deductible really impacted us financially really in a difficult way. And then the other question I had, so I'm wondering if that is allowed, and then the other question I had is they often will reduce the amount of our psychotherapy visits and then pay their percentage of that reduced amount because they say it exceeds the reasonable and customary charge, even though I'm not finding any psychotherapists that charge less than what we're doing. So I'm wondering where they get these reasonable and customary charges, and then are they allowed to reduce it?
Jennifer, thank you. Devin Herrick, what do you know about that?
Well, I was not aware. I think Jenny mentioned earlier in the program that it's becoming increasingly rare to have separate deductibles. Most firms, or most insurers and health plans have realized that that's really I don't even think it's legal, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm an economist. So I don't think that's nearly as prevalent as it used to be. But, you know, you will, I mean, as far as usual and customary, that is usually a function of the various providers in the area. It might be the median price, maybe just above the median price. I can't really say the exact mechanism, but I kind of understand that it's generally a function of surveys they've done. And it may well be lower than, and it may be because their network providers have a lower cost than some of those that are out of network.
Mehran, would you jump in here on that point?
Sure. So actually, it's a fascinating point. When it comes to rates of reimbursement, to my knowledge, I don't believe I know of any state that actually requires an insurer to adhere to any particular benchmark. And so insurers are pretty much free to devise their own. Many of them use Medicare as a benchmark, not all. We're seeing that in some of the Affordable Care Act plans, insurers are using secret benchmarks that are not disclosed to the public. And the rates of reimbursement are so low as to essentially nullify the opportunity for folks to get access to meaningful networks, or certainly to go out of network. And so people are purchasing policies with out-of-network benefits that are essentially illusory. So we really need to tackle the issue of transparency and consistency in having benchmarks for reimbursement. That's a real problem, and it's certainly not just a mental health issue. It's a health issue, and it is certainly not unique.
Here's Maggie in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Maggie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
So I'm a mental health provider up here in Gloucester, and I find that I'm always having to battle with insurance companies to continue weekly therapy with a lot of my clients who have chronic major mental illness, such as bipolar 1 or schizophrenia or major depression, because the insurance companies want to see it step down to maybe 2 times a month or once a month and be in that maintenance phase. And yet, when it's weekly, that's how we prevent the more expensive, more costly inpatient treatment. And yet it's a constant battle of having to prove medical necessity for them to cover the treatment that really is actually necessary. Mm.
Jenny Gold, speak to Maggie's point, please.
I've heard that a lot from various providers that, you know, they're often in the position of having to argue with an insurance company repeatedly as to why their patient's care is necessary. And the insurance company will often come back and say, well, we consulted with our psychiatrists or our therapists, and we believe it isn't necessary. I reported on Kaiser Permanente in California, again, I work for Kaiser Health News, not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente, but found that the Department of Managed Healthcare in California went after Kaiser and Kaiser Permanente, and because they were telling clients that they were never allowed to have long-term therapy, that long-term therapy just wasn't even a benefit that was covered under Kaiser Permanente. They were fined $4 million for that in 2013, but when the state went back in 2015 to make sure that they had changed their ways, it found, well, they'd improved some things, but they had not changed that.
Mm. Let me get a last call in here, Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Craig. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
Insurance companies only have so much money coming in. When that nears depletion, they're going to start manipulation.
So they can't do anything else. They're stuck. Is that what you're saying, Craig?
Yeah, there's only so much money, and then what can they do? They'll start manipulating.
Mehran, there's only so much in the pot, Craig says. So what else do you want them to do?
Well, have you seen some of their SEC filings and financial returns in the past few years? I'm not familiar with too many insurance companies that are actually losing money. In fact, I believe that Blue Shield in California just lost its tax exempt status with the, or by the Franchise Tax Board, because it was apparently seen as holding on to too much money. So I'm not sure that that has a whole lot of resonance for me.
So, Jenny Gold, speak to where this is all going. We had a federal appeals court ruling on this. A lot of private lawsuits, like Mehram Bendat has been talking about this hour. Where do you see the parity law going from here?
Well, I think what's going to have to happen if it's going to really work is that state and federal governments are going to have to step up their enforcement. Part of the problem here is that insurers say that they don't even know necessarily what's right and what's not. So the federal government, for example, the Department of Labor is sort of the main agency in charge of this, and they haven't gotten that many complaints from people, I think largely because of this sort of stigma issue. They found 140 cases of alleged parity violations based on consumer complaints, but all of them were resolved through this voluntary compliance process. Nothing was made public. So other insurers aren't able to look and say, oh, this is allowed, that's not allowed. There needs to be some more clarity for insurance companies. And I think the states and the federal government really need to make clear that they're watching this. They're watching what's happening, and they're going to make sure that parity is being enforced fairly.
Devin Herrick, you're the last word here in our last 20 seconds. What's the right balance on this issue, given this conversation and where you stand? What's the happy medium for you?
Well, the mental health parity and how it applies to health plans and to the Affordable Care Act is a work in progress. I think over time, the health insurers and the government payers, as well as the private payers, will begin to work out the appropriate protocols and step therapies and, you know, and accountable care. So we haven't got there yet, but I think we're getting there.
Devin Herrick, Senior Fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. Thanks so much for your time today, Devin.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Mehram Bendat, lawyer and psychotherapist. Really appreciate your perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Jenny Gold with Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much for your reporting and bringing this issue to our attention. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.